This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Beautiful Ruins by Jess Walter. Performed by Eduardo Ballerini. To Anne, Brooklyn, Ava, and Alec. The ancient Romans built their greatest masterpieces of architecture for wild beasts to fight in, Voltaire, the complete letters. Cleopatra, I will not have love as my master, Mark Antony, then you will not have love, from the 1963 disaster film, Cleopatra. Dick Cavett's four great interviews with Richard Burton were done in 1980. Burton, 54 at the time, and already a beautiful ruin, was mesmerizing. Talk Story by Louis Menand, The New Yorker, November 22, 2010.
Chapter 1. The Dying Actress. April 1962. Porto Vergogna, Italy. The dying actress arrived in his village the only way one could come directly, in a boat that motored into the cove, lurched past the rock jetty, and bumped against the end of the pier. She wavered a moment in the boat's stern, then extended a slender hand to grip the mahogany railing. With the other, she pressed a wide-brimmed hat against her head. All around her, shards of sunlight broke on the flickering waves. 20 meters away, Pasquale Tursi watched the arrival of the woman as if in a dream. Or rather, he would think later, a dream's opposite, a burst of clarity after a lifetime of sleep. Pasquale straightened and stopped what he was doing, what he was usually doing that spring, trying to construct a beach below his family's empty pensione. Chest deep in the cold Ligurian sea, Pasquale was tossing rocks the size of cats in an attempt to fortify the breakwater, to keep the waves from hauling away his little mound of construction sand. Pasquale's beach was only as wide as 2 fishing boats, and the ground beneath his dusting of sand was scalloped rock, but it was the closest thing to a flat piece of shoreline in the entire village. A rumor of a town that had ironically, or perhaps hopefully, been designated Porto, despite the fact that the only boats to come in and out regularly belonged to the village's handful of sardine and anchovy fishermen. The rest of the name, Vergogna, meant shame, and was a remnant from the founding of the village in the 17th century, as a place for sailors and fishers to find women of a certain moral and commercial flexibility. On the day he first saw the lovely American, Pasquale was chest-deep in daydreams as well, imagining grubby little Porto Vergogna as an emergent resort town, and himself as a sophisticated businessman of the 1960s, a man of infinite possibility at the dawn of a glorious modernity. Everywhere he saw signs of il boom, the surge in wealth and literacy that was transforming Italy. Why not here? He'd recently come home from 4 years in bustling Florence, returning to the tiny backward village of his youth, imagining that he brought vital news of the world out there, a glittering era of shiny macchine, of televisions and telephones, of double martinis and women in slender pants, of the kind of world that had seemed to exist before only in the cinema. Porto Vergogna was a tight cluster of a dozen old whitewashed houses, an abandoned chapel, and the town's only commercial interest, the tiny hotel and café owned by Pasquale's family, all huddled like a herd of sleeping goats in a crease in the sheer cliffs. Behind the village, the rocks rose 600 feet to a wall of black striated mountains. Below it, The sea settled in a rocky, shrimp-curled cove, from which the fishermen put in and out every day. Isolated by the cliffs behind and the sea in front, the village had never been accessible by car or cart, and so the streets, such as they were, consisted of a few narrow pathways between the houses, brick-lined roads skinnier than sidewalks, plunging alleys and rising staircases so narrow that unless one was standing in the Piazza San Pietro, the little town square, it was possible anywhere in the village to reach out and touch walls on either side. In this way, remote Porto Vergogna was not so different from the quaint cliffside towns of the Cinque Terre to the north, except that it was smaller, more remote, and not as picturesque. In fact, the hoteliers and restaurateurs to the north had their own pet name for the tiny village pinched into the vertical cliff seam. Baldracaculo, the whore's crack. Yet despite his neighbor's disdain, Pasquale had come to believe, as his father had, that Porto Vergogna could someday flourish like the rest of the Levante, the coastline south of Genoa that included the Cinque Terre, or even the larger tourist cities on the Ponente, Portofino, and the sophisticated Italian Riviera. The rare foreign tourists who boated or hiked into Porto Vergogna tended to be lost French or Swiss, but Pasquale held out hope that the 1960s would bring a flood of Americans, led by the bravissimo U.S. President John Kennedy and his wife Jacqueline. And yet, if his village had any chance of becoming the destinazione turistica primaria he dreamed of, Pasquale knew it would need to attract such vacationers, and to do that it would need, first of all, a beach. And so Pasquale stood half-submerged, holding a big rock beneath his chin as the red mahogany boat bobbed into his cove. His old friend Orenzio was piloting it for the wealthy vintner and hotelier Gualfredo, who ran the tourism south of Genoa, but whose fancy 10-meter sport boat rarely came to Porto Vergogna. Pasquale watched the boat settle in its chop, and could think of nothing to do but call out, "Orenzio!" His friend was confused by the greeting. They had been friends since they were 12, but they were not yellers, he and Pasquale, more acknowledgers, lip-raisers, eyebrow-tippers. Orenzio nodded back grimly. He was serious when he had tourists in his boat, especially Americans. "They are serious people, Americans," Orenzio had explained to Pasquale once. "Even more suspicious than Germans. If you smile too much, Americans assume you're stealing from them." Today, Orenzio was especially dour-faced, shooting a glance toward the woman in the back of his boat, her long tan coat pulled tight around her thin waist, her floppy hat covering most of her face. Then the woman said something quietly to Orenzio, and it carried across the water. Gibberish, Pasquale thought at first, until he recognized it as English, American, in fact. "Pardon me, what is that man doing?" Pasquale knew his friend was insecure about his limited English and tended to answer questions in that awful language as tersely as possible. Orenzio glanced over at Pasquale, holding a big rock for the breakwater he was building, and attempted the English word for spiaggia, beach, saying with a hint of impatience, "Beach." The woman cocked her head as if she hadn't heard right. Pasquale tried to help, muttering that the bitch was for the tourists. "Per I turisti." But the beautiful American didn't seem to hear. It was an inheritance from his father, Pasquale's dream of tourism. Carlo Tursi had spent the last decade of his life trying to get the five larger villages of the Cinque Terre to accept Porto Vergogna as the sixth in the string. "How much nicer," he used to say. "Sei terre, the six lands. Cinque terre is so hard on tourists' tongues." But tiny Porto Vergogna lacked the charm and political pull of its five larger neighbors. So while the five were connected by telephone lines, and eventually by a tunneled rail line, and swelled with seasonal tourists and their money, the sixth atrophied like an extra finger. Carlo's other fruitless ambition had been to get those vital rail lines tunneled another kilometer, to link Porto Vergogna to the larger cliffside towns. But this never happened. And since the nearest road cut behind the terraced vineyards that backed the Cinque Terre cliffs, Porto Vergogna remained cut off, alone in its wrinkle in the black-ribbed rocks, only the sea in front and steep foot trails descending the cliffs behind. On the day the luminous American arrived, Pasquale's father had been dead for 8 months. Carlo's passing had been quick and quiet, a vessel bursting in his brain while he read one of his beloved newspapers. Over and over, Pasquale replayed his father's last 10 minutes. He sipped an espresso, dragged a cigarette, laughed at an item in the Milan newspaper. Pasquale's mother saved the page but never found anything funny in it, and then slumped forward as if he were napping. Pasquale was at the University of Florence when he got the news of his father's death. After the funeral, he begged his elderly mother to move to Florence, but the very idea scandalized her. "What kind of wife would I be if I left your father simply because he is dead?" It left no question, at least in Pasquale's mind, that he must come home and care for his frail mother. So Pasquale moved back into his old room in the hotel. And perhaps it was guilt over having dismissed his father's ideas when he was younger, but Pasquale could suddenly see it. His family's small inn, through newly inherited eyes. Yes, this town could become a new kind of Italian resort, an American getaway, parasols on the rocky shore, camera shutters snapping, Kennedys everywhere. And if there was a measure of self-interest in turning the empty pensione into a world-class resort, so be it. The old hotel was his only inheritance, the sole familial advantage in a culture that required it. The hotel was comprised of a trattoria, a three-table café, a kitchen and two small apartments on the first floor, and the six rooms of the old brothel above it. With the hotel came the responsibility of caring for its only regular tenants, le due streghe, as the fishermen called them, the two witches, Pasquale's crippled mother, Antonia, and her wire-haired sister, Valeria, the ogre who did most of the cooking when she wasn't yelling at the lazy fisherman and the rare guest who stumbled in. Pasquale was nothing if not tolerant, and he abided the eccentricities of his melodramatic mamma and his crazy zia just as he put up with the crude fishermen. Each morning skidding their peschereccio down to the shoreline and pushing out into the sea, the small wooden shells rocking on the waves like dirty salad bowls, thrumming with the bup-bup of their smoking outboards. Each day the fishermen netted just enough anchovies, sardines, and sea bass to sell to the markets and restaurants to the south, before coming back to drink grappa and smoke the bitter cigarettes they rolled themselves. His father had always taken great pains to separate himself and his son, descendants, Carlo claimed, of an esteemed Florentine merchant class, from these coarse fishermen. "Look at them," he would say to Pasquale from behind one of the many newspapers that arrived weekly on the mailboat. "In a more civilized time, they would have been our servants." Having lost two older sons in the war, Carlo wasn't about to let his youngest son work on the fishing boats, or in the canneries in La Spezia, or in the terraced vineyards, or in the marble quarries in the Apennines, or anywhere else a young man might learn some valuable skill and shake the feeling that he was soft and out of place in the hard world. Instead, Carlo and Antonia, already 40 when Pasquale was born, raised Pasquale like a secret between them. And it was only after some pleading that his aging parents had even allowed him to go to university in Florence. When Pasquale returned after his father's death, the fishermen were unsure what to think of him. At first they attributed his strange behavior, always reading, talking to himself, measuring things, dumping bags of construction sand on the rocks and raking it like a vain man combing his last wisps of hair, to grief. They strung their nets, and they watched the slender 21-year-old rearrange rocks in hopes of keeping storms from hauling away his beach. And their eyes dewed over with memories of the empty dreams of their own dead fathers. But soon the fishermen began to miss the good-natured ribbing they'd always given Carlo Tursi. Finally, after watching Pasquale work on his beach for a few weeks, the fishermen could stand it no longer. One day, Tommaso the Elder tossed the young man a matchbox and called out, "Here is a chair for your tiny beach, Pasquale!" After weeks of unnatural kindness, the gentle mockery was a relief, the bursting of storm clouds above the village. Life was back to normal.
"Pasquale, I saw part of your beach yesterday at Lerici. Shall I take the rest of the sand up there, or will you wait for the current to deliver it?"
But a beach was something the fishermen could at least understand. After all, there were beaches in Monte Rosso al Mare, and in the Riviera towns to the north, where the town's fishermen sold the bulk of their catches. When Pasquale announced his intention to carve a tennis court into a cluster of boulders in the cliffs, however, the fishermen declared Pasquale even more unhinged than his father. "The boy has lost his sense," they said from the small piazza, as they hand-rolled cigarettes and watched Pasquale scamper over the boulders, marking the boundaries of his future tennis court with string.
"It's a family of pazzi. Soon he'll be talking to cats."
With nothing but steep cliff faces to work with, Pasquale knew that a golf course was out of the question. But there was a natural shelf of three boulders near his hotel, and if he could level the tops and cantilever the rest, he thought he could build forms and pour enough concrete to connect the boulders into a flat rectangle and create, like a vision rising out of the rocky cliffs, a tennis court, announcing to visitors arriving by sea that they had come upon a first-class resort. He could close his eyes and see it. Men in clean white pants, lobbing balls back and forth on a stunning court projecting out from the cliffs, a glorious shelf 20 meters above the shoreline. Women in dresses and summer hats sipping drinks beneath nearby parasols. So he chipped away with a pick and chisels and hammers, hoping to prepare a large enough space for a tennis court. He raked his dusting of sand. He tossed rocks in the sea. He endured the teasing of the fishermen. He peeked in on his dying mother, and he waited, as he always had, for life to come and find him. For 8 months after his father's death, this was the sum of Pasquale Tursi's life. And if he wasn't entirely happy, he wasn't unhappy either. Rather, he found himself inhabiting the vast, empty plateau where most people live, between boredom and contentment. And perhaps this is where he would have always lived, had not the beautiful American arrived on this cool, sunny afternoon. Pasquale standing chest-deep in the water 20 meters away, watching the mahogany boat come to rest against the wooden bollards of the pier. The woman standing in the stern, gentle wind ruffling the sea around her. She was impossibly thin, and yet amply curved, the beautiful American. From Pasquale's vantage in the sea, sun flickering behind her, wind snapping her wheat-blonde hair, it was as if she were another species, taller and more ethereal than any woman he'd ever seen. Orenzio offered her a hand, and after a moment of hesitation, she took it. He helped her from his boat onto the narrow pier.
"Thank you," came an uncertain voice from beneath the hat, and then, "grazie," the Italian word breathy and unpracticed. She took her first step toward the village, seemed to stagger a moment, and then regained her balance. It was then that she pulled the hat off to get a look at the village, and Pasquale saw her full features, and was mildly surprised the beautiful American wasn't, well, more beautiful. Oh, she was striking, certainly, but not in the way he'd expected. First, she was as tall as Pasquale, nearly 6 feet. And from where he stood, weren't her features a bit too much for such a narrow face? Plunging jawline so pronounced, mouth so full, eyes so round and open that she seemed startled. And could a woman be too thin, so that her curve seemed sudden, alarming? Her long hair was pulled back into a ponytail, and her skin was lightly tanned, drawn tight over features that were somehow at once too sharp and too soft. Nose too delicate for such a chin, for such high cheeks, for those big dark eyes. No, he thought, while she was striking, this was no great beauty. But then she turned directly to him, and the disparate features of her drastic face came together as a single perfect thing. And Pasquale recalled from his studies how some buildings in Florence could disappoint from various angles, and yet always presented well in relief, always photographed well, that the various vantages were made to be composed. And so, too, he thought, some people. Then she smiled, and in that instant, if such a thing were possible, Pasquale fell in love. And he would remain in love for the rest of his life. Not so much with the woman whom he didn't even know, but with the moment. He dropped the rock he was holding. She glanced away, right, then left, then right again, as if looking for the rest of the village. Pasquale flushed over what she must be seeing, a dozen or so drab stone houses, some of them abandoned, clinging like barnacles to the cliff seam. Feral cats poked around the small piazza, but otherwise all was quiet, the fishermen out in their boats for the day. Pasquale sensed such disappointment when people hiked in accidentally, or arrived by boat through a mistake in cartography or language, people who believed they were being taken to the charming tourist towns of Porto Venere or Porto Fino, only to find themselves in the brutto fishing village of Porto Vergogna. "I'm sorry," the beautiful American said in English, turning back to Orenzio. "Should I help with the bags? Or is it part of... I mean, I don't know what has been paid for and what hasn't." Done with devilish English after that beach business, Orenzio merely shrugged. Short, jug-eared, and dull-eyed, he carried himself in a manner that often suggested brain damage to tourists, who were so impressed by this slack-eyed simpleton's ability to operate a motorboat that they tipped him lavishly. Orenzio, in turn, surmised that the duller he behaved and the less English he mastered, the more he would be paid. So he stared and blinked stupidly. "Should I get my own luggage, then?" the woman asked again, patiently, a little helplessly. "Bagagli, Orenzio!" Pasquale called to his friend, and then it dawned on Pasquale. This woman was checking into his hotel. Pasquale started wading over to the pier, licking his lips in preparation for speaking unpracticed English. "Please," he said to the woman, his tongue like a hunk of gristle in his mouth. "I have honor and Orenzio for carry you bag. Go upon adequate view hotel." The comment appeared to confuse the American, but Pasquale didn't notice. He wanted to end with a flourish, and tried to think of the proper word to call her. "Madame?" But he longed for something better. He had never really mastered English, but he'd studied enough to have a healthy fear of its random severity, the senseless brutality of its conjugations. It was unpredictable, like a crossbred dog. His earliest education in the language had come from the only American to ever stay in the hotel, a writer who came to Italy each spring to chip away at his life's work, an epic novel about his experiences in World War II. Pasquale tried to imagine what the tall, dashing writer might say to this woman, but he couldn't think of the right words, and he wondered if there was an English equivalent for the Italian staple bella, beautiful. He took a stab. "Please, come, beautiful America." She stared at him for just a moment, the longest moment of his life to that point, then smiled and looked down demurely. "Thank you. Is this your hotel?" Pasquale finished sloshing through the water and arrived at the pier. He pulled himself up, shaking the water from his pant legs, and tried to present himself, every bit the dashing hotelier. "Yes, is my hotel." Pasquale pointed to the small, hand-lettered sign on the left side of the piazza. Please. And you have a room reserved for us?
Oh, yes. Many is room. All is room for you. Yes.
She looked at the sign, and then at Pasquale again. The warm gust was back, and it roused the escaped hairs from her ponytail into streamers around her face. She smiled at the puddle dripping off his thin frame, then looked up into his sea-blue eyes and said, "You have lovely eyes." Then she replaced the hat on her head and started making her way toward the small piazza and the center of what little town lay before her. Porto Vergogna had never had un liceo, a high school, and so Pasquale had boated to La Spezia for secondary school. This was where he'd met Orenzio, who became his first real friend. They were tossed together by default, the shy son of the old hotelier and the short, jug-eared wharf boy. Pasquale had even stayed sometimes with Orenzio's family during the winter weeks when the passage was difficult. The winter before Pasquale left for Florence, he and Orenzio had invented a game that they played over glasses of Swiss beer. They would sit across from each other at the docks in La Spezia and fire offenses back and forth until they either ran out of words or started repeating themselves, at which point the loser would have to drain the pint before him. Now, as he hoisted the American's bags, Orenzio leaned over to Pasquale and played a dry version of the game.
"What did she say? Not smeller." "She loves my eyes," Pasquale said, missing his cue. "Come on, ass handler," Orenzio said. "She said nothing like this."
"No, she did. She is in love with my eyes."
"You are a liar, Pasquo, and an admirer of boys' noodles."
"It is true."
"But you love boys' noodles?"
"No. She said that about my eyes."
"You are a fellator of goats.
The woman is a cinema star."
"I think so too," Pasquale said.
"No, stupid. She really is a performer of the cinema. She's with the American company working on the film in Rome."
"What film?"
"Cleopatra. Don't you read the newspaper, shit smoker?"
Pasquale looked back at the American actress, who was climbing the steps to the village.
"But she's too fair-skinned to play Cleopatra."
"The whore and husband thief Elizabeth Taylor is Cleopatra," Orenzio said. "This is another player in the film. Do you really not read the newspapers, bung slapper?"
"Which role is she?"
"How should I know? There must be many roles."
"What's her name?"
Pasquale asked. Orenzio handed over the typed instructions he'd been given. The paper included the woman's name, said that she should be taken to the hotel in Porto Vergogna, and that the bill should be sent to the man who had arranged her trip, Michael Dean, at the Grand Hotel in Rome. The single sheet of paper said that this Michael Dean was a special production assistant for 20th Century Fox Pictures. And the woman's name? "Di More," Pasquale read aloud. It wasn't familiar, but there were so many American movie stars. Rock Hudson's, Marilyn Monroe's, John Wayne's. And just when he thought he knew them all, some new one became famous, almost as if there were a factory in America manufacturing these huge movie screen faces. Pasquale looked back up to where she was already making her way up the steps of the cliff seam and into the waiting village. "Di More," he said again. Orenzio looked over his shoulder at the paper.
"Di More,"
Orenzio said. There was something intriguing in the name, and neither man could stop saying it.
"Di More," Orenzio said again. "She's sick," Orenzio said to Pasquale.
"With what?"
"How would I know this? The man just said she was sick."
"Is it serious?"
"I don't know this either."
And then, as if winding down, as if even he were losing interest in their old game, Orenzio added another insult.
"Uno che mangia culo."
"One who eats ass." Pasquale watched as Di More moved toward his hotel, taking small steps along the stone pathway.
She can't be too sick, he said. She's beautiful.
But not like Sophia Loren, Orencio said, or the Marilyn Monroe.
It had been their other pastime the winter before, going to the cinema and rating the women they saw.
No, I think she has a more intelligent beauty, like Anouk Aimée.
She's so skinny, Orencio said, and she's no Claudia Cardinale.
No, Pasquale had to agree. Claudia Cardinale was perfection. I think it is not so common, though, her face.
The point had become too fine for Orencio.
I could bring a three-legged dog into this town, Pasco, and you would fall in love with it.
That's when Pasquale became worried.
Orencio, did she intend to come here?
Orencio smacked the page in Pasquale's hand.
This American, Dean, who drove her to La Spezia, I explained to him that no one comes here. I asked if he meant Portofino or Porto Venere. He asked what Porto Vergogna was like, and I said there was nothing here but a hotel. He asked if the town was quiet. I said to him, only death is quieter. And he said, then that is the place.
Pasquale smiled at his friend.
Thank you, Orencio.
Filleter of goats,
Orencio said quietly.
You already said that one,
Pasquale said. Orencio mimed finishing a beer. Then they both looked toward the cliffside, 40 meters uphill, where the first American guest since the death of his father stood regarding the front door of his hotel. Here is the future, thought Pasquale. Dee Morey stopped and looked back down at them. She shook out her ponytail, and her sun-bleached hair snapped and danced around her face as she took in the sea from the village square. Then she looked at the sign and cocked her head, as if trying to understand the words. The Hotel, Adequate View. And then the future tucked her floppy hat under her arm, pushed open the door, ducked, and went in. After she disappeared inside the hotel, Pasquale entertained the unwieldy thought that he'd somehow summoned her, that after years of living in this place, after months of grief and loneliness and waiting for Americans, he'd created this woman from old bits of cinema and books, from the lost artifacts and ruins of his dreams, from his epic, enduring solitude. He glanced over at Orencio, who was carrying someone's bags, and the whole world suddenly seemed so unlikely, our time in it so brief and dreamlike. He'd never felt such a detached existential sensation, such terrifying freedom. It was as if he were hovering above the village, above his own body, and it thrilled him in a way that he could never have explained. Di More, Pasquale Tursi said, suddenly, aloud, breaking the spell of his thoughts. Orencio looked over. Then Pasquale turned his back and said the name again, to himself this time, in something less than a whisper, embarrassed by the hopeful breath that formed those words. Life, he thought, is a blatant act of imagination.
Chapter 2. The Last Pitch. Recently, Hollywood, California. Before sunrise, before Guatemalan gardeners and dirty-dinged lawn trucks, before Caribbeans come to cook, clean, and clothe, before Montessori, Pilates, and coffee bean, before Benzes and BMWs nose onto palm streets and the blue-toothed sharks resume their endless business, the gentrification of the American mind, there are the sprinklers, rising from the ground to spit-spray the northwest corner of Greater Los Angeles, airport to the hills, downtown to the beaches, the slumbering rubble of the entertainment regime. In Santa Monica, they call to Claire Silver in the pre-dawn quiet of her condo. Psst, hey. Her curly red hair splayed out on the pillow like a suicide. They whisper again, psst, hey. And Claire's eyelids flutter. She inhales, orients, glances over at the marbled shoulder of her boyfriend,
sprawled asleep on his 70% of the king size. Daryl often cracks the bedroom window behind their bed when he comes in late, and Claire wakes like this, psst, hey, to water spritzing the rock garden outside. She's asked the condo manager why it's necessary to water a bed of rocks every day at 5 a.m., or at all, for that matter. But of course, sprinklers are not the real issue. Claire wakes, jonesing for data. She fumbles on the crowded bedside table for her BlackBerry, takes a digital hit. 14 emails, 6 tweets, 5 friend requests, 3 texts, and her calendar. Life in a palm. General stuff, too. Friday, 66 degrees, on the way to 74, 5 phone calls scheduled today, 6 pitch meetings. Then, amid the info dump, she sees a life-changing email from affinity@arc.net. She opens it. Dear Claire, thanks again for your patience during this long process. Both Brian and I were very impressed by your credentials and your interview, and we'd like to meet you to talk more. Would you be available for coffee this morning? Sincerely, James Pierce, Museum of American Screen Culture. Claire sits up. Holy shit. They're going to offer her the job. Or are they? Talk more? They've already interviewed her twice. What can they possibly need to talk about? Is this it? Is today the day she gets to quit her dream job? Claire is chief development assistant for the legendary film producer Michael Dean. The title's phony. Her job's all assisting, no developing, and she's nobody's chief. She tends Michael's whims, answers his calls and emails, goes for his sandwiches and coffee, and mostly she reads for him. Great herds of scripts and synopses, one-sheets and treatments, a stampede of material going nowhere. She'd hoped for so much more when she quit her doctoral film studies program and went to work for the man who was known in the 70s and 80s as the Dean of Hollywood. She'd wanted to make movies. Smart, moving films. But when she arrived 3 years ago, Michael Dean was in the worst slump of his career, with no recent credits save the indie zombie bomb Night Ravagers. In Claire's 3 years, Dean Productions has made no other movies. In fact, its only production has been a single television program, the hit reality show and dating website Hookbook, hookbook.net. And with the monstrous success of that cross-media abomination, movies have become a fading memory at Dean Productions. Instead, Claire's days are spent listening to TV pitches so offensive she fears she's single-handedly hastening the apocalypse. Model behavior. We take 7 models and put them in a frat house. And Nympho Night. We film the dates of people diagnosed with sex addiction. And Drunk Midget House. See, it's a house full of drunk midgets. Michael's constantly urging her to adjust her expectations, to set aside her highbrow pretensions, to accept the culture on its own terms, to expand her notion of what's good. If you want to make art, he's fond of saying, go get a job at the Louvre. So that's what she did. A month ago, Claire applied for a job she saw posted on a website for a curator for a new private film museum. And now, almost 3 weeks after her interview, the crisp businessman on the museum's board of directors appeared to be close to offering her the job. If it's a no-brainer, this decision is a quarter-brainer at most. Their proposed Museum of American Screen Culture, MASC, will pay better, the hours will be better, and it's certainly a better use of her master's degree from UCLA in moving image archive studies. More than that, she thinks the job might allow her to feel like she's actually using her brain again. Michael is dismissive of this intellectual discontent of hers, insisting that she's just paying her dues, that every producer spends a few years in the wilderness, that, in Michael's clipped, inimitable lingo, she must sift shit for the corn. Make her bones with a commercial success or 10 so that she can later do the projects she loves. And so she finds herself here, at life's big crossroad, stick it out with this crass career and her unlikely dream of one day making a great film? Or take a quiet job cataloging relics from a time when film actually mattered? Faced with such decisions, college, boyfriends, grad school, Claire has always been a pro-con lister, a seeker of signs, a deal-maker. And she makes a deal with herself now, or with fate. Either a good, viable film idea walks in the door today, or I quit. This deal, of course, is rigged. Convinced that the money is all in TV now, Michael hasn't liked a single film pitch, script, or treatment in 2 years. And everything she likes, he dismisses as too expensive, too dark, too period, not commercial enough. As if that didn't make the odds long enough, today is Wild Pitch Friday, the last Friday of the month, set aside for off-the-rack pitches from Michael's old cronies and colleagues, from every burned-out, played-out has-been and never was in town. And on this particular Wild Pitch Friday, both Michael and his producing partner, Danny Roth, have the day off. Today, psst, hey, she has all these shit pitches to herself. Claire glances down at Daryl, snoozing in the bed next to her. She twinges guilt for not talking to him about the museum job. This is partly because he's been out late almost every night, partly because they haven't been talking much anyway, partly because she's thinking of quitting him, too. "So?" she says quietly. Daryl makes a deep sleep noise, something between a grunt and a peep. "Yeah," she says. "That's what I figured." She rises and stretches, starts for the bathroom. But on the way, she pauses over Daryl's jeans, which sit like a resting dancer on the floor right where he's stepped out of them. "Psst, don't," the sprinklers warn. But what choice does she have, really? A young woman at the crossroads, on the lookout for signs. She bends, picks up the jeans, goes through the pockets. 6 singles, coins, a book of matches, and, here it is. A punch card for something charmingly called Ass-tacular, the Southland's finest in live nude entertainment. Daryl's diversion. She turns the card over. Claire doesn't have much of an instinct for the gradations of the adult entertainment industry, but she imagines the employment of punch cards doesn't exactly distinguish ass-tacular as the 4 seasons of titty bars. Oh, and look! Daryl is just 2 punches from a free lap dance. How excellent for him! She leaves the card next to the snoring Daryl on her pillow in the indentation left by her head. Then Claire starts for the bathroom, officially adding Daryl to her deal with fate, like a hostage. Bring me a great film idea today, or the strip-clubbing boyfriend gets it. She pictures the names on her schedule, and wonders if one will magically step up. She imagines them as fixed points on a map. Her 9:30 having an egg white omelet as he goes over his pitch in Culver City. Her 10:15 doing Tai Chi in Manhattan Beach. Her 11 rubbing one off in the shower in Silver Lake. It's liberating to pretend her decision is up to them now, that she's done all she can, and Claire feels almost free, stepping openly, nakedly, into the capricious arms of destiny, or at least into a hot shower. And that's when a single wistful thought escapes her otherwise made-up mind. A wish, or maybe a prayer, that amid today's crap, she might hear just one decent pitch, one idea for a great film, so she won't have to quit the only job she's ever wanted in her entire life. Outside, the sprinklers spit laughter against the rock garden. Also naked, 800 miles away in Beaverton, Oregon, Claire's last appointment of the day, her 4 p.m., can't decide what to wear. Not quite 30, Shane Wheeler is tall, lean, and a little feral-looking, narrow face framed by an ocean chop of brown hair and 2 table-leg sideburns. For 20 minutes, Shane has been coaxing an outfit from this autumn leaf pile of discarded clothes. Wrinkly polos,
quirky second-hand tees, faux Western button shirts, boot-cut jeans, skinny jeans, torn jeans, slacks, khakis, and cords. None of it quite right for the too-talented-to-care nonchalance he imagines is appropriate for his first-ever Hollywood pitch meeting. Shane absent-mindedly rubs the tattoo on his left forearm, the word ACT, inked in elaborate gangster calligraphy, a reference to his father's favorite Bible passage and, until recently, Shane's life motto. Act as if ye have faith, and it shall be given to you. His was an outlook fed by years of episodic TV, by encouraging teachers and counselors, by science fair ribbons, participant medals, and soccer and basketball trophies, and most of all, by two attentive and dutiful parents, who raised their five perfect children with the belief, hell, with the birthright, that as long as they had faith in themselves, they could be anything they wanted to be. So in high school, Shane acted as if he were a distance runner and lettered twice, acted as if he were an A student and pulled them, acted as if a certain cheerleader were in his wheelhouse and she asked him to a dance, acted as if he were a shoo-in for Cal Berkeley and got in, and for Sigma Nu and they pledged him, acted as if he spoke Italian and studied abroad for a year, acted as if he were a writer and got accepted to the University of Arizona's MFA Creative Writing Program, acted as if he were in love and got married. But recently, fissures have appeared in this philosophy, faith proving to be not nearly enough. And it was in the run-up to his divorce that his soon-to-be ex-wife, so tired of your shit, Shane, dropped a bombshell. The Bible phrase he and his father endlessly quoted, "Act as if ye have faith," never actually appears in the Bible. Rather, as far as she could tell, it came from the closing argument given by the Paul Newman character in the film The Verdict. This revelation didn't cause Shane's trouble, but the news did seem to explain it somehow. This is what happens when your life is authored not by God, but by David Mamet. You can't find a teaching job, and your marriage dissolves just as your student loans come due, and the project you've worked on for 6 years, your MFA thesis, a book of linked short stories called Linked, is rejected by the literary agent you've secured. Agent: this book doesn't work. Shane: you mean in your opinion. Agent: I mean in English. Divorced, jobless, and broke, his literary ambition scuttled, Shane saw his decision to become a writer as a 6-year detour to nowhere. He was in the first funk of his life, unable to even get out of bed without ACT to spur him on. It fell to his mother to yank him out of it, convincing him to go on antidepressants and hopefully rescuing the blithely confident young man she and his father had raised. "Look, it's not like we were a religious family anyway. We only went to church on Christmas and Easter. So your dad got that saying from a 30-year-old movie instead of a 2,000-year-old book. That doesn't mean it isn't true, does it? In fact, maybe that makes it more true." Inspired by his mother's deep faith in him, and by the low dose of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor he'd recently begun taking, Shane had what could only be described as an epiphany. Weren't movies his generation's faith anyway? Its true religion? Wasn't the theater our temple? The one place we enter separately but emerge from 2 hours later together with the same experience, same guided emotions, same moral? A million schools taught 10 million curricula. A million churches featured 10,000 sects with a billion sermons. But the same movie showed in every mall in the country. And we all saw it. That summer, the one you'll never forget, every movie house beamed the same set of thematic and narrative images, the same Avatar, same Harry Potter, same Fast and the Furious, flickering pictures stitched in our minds that replaced our own memories, archetypal stories that became our shared history, that taught us what to expect from life,
that defined our values. What was that but a religion? Also, movies paid better than books. And so Shane decided to take his talents to Hollywood. He started by contacting his old writing professor, Gene Pergo, who had tired of being a teacher and ignored essayist, and had written a thriller called Night Ravagers. Hot-rodding zombies cruise post-apocalyptic Los Angeles looking for human survivors to enslave. Selling the film rights for more than he'd made in a decade of academia and small house publishing, and quitting his teaching job mid-semester. At the time, Shane was in the second year of his MFA, and Gene's defection was what passed for scandal in the program. Faculty and students alike huffing at the way Gene shat all over the Cathedral of Literature. Shane tracked Professor Pergo down in L.A., where he was adapting the second book of what was now a trilogy, Night Ravagers 2, Streets of Reckoning, 3D. Gene said that in the last 2 years, he'd heard from roughly every student and colleague I ever worked with. Those most scandalized by his literary abdication had been the first to call. Gene gave Shane the name of a film agent, Andrew Dunn, and the titles of screenwriting books by Sid Field and Robert McKee, and, best of all, the chapter on pitching from the producer Michael Dean's inspiring autobiography, The Dean's Way, How I Pitched Modern Hollywood to America, and How You Can Pitch Success into Your Life Too. It was a line in Dean's book. In the room, the only thing you need to believe is yourself. You are your story. That had Shane recalling his old act self-confidence, honing his pitch, looking for apartments in L.A., even phoning his old literary agent. Shane, I thought you should know I'm officially done with books. Agent, I'll inform the Nobel Committee. And today, it all pays off. With Shane's first ever pitch to a Hollywood producer, and not just any producer, but Michael Dean himself, or at least Dean's assistant, Claire Somebody. Today, with Claire Somebody's help, Shane Wheeler takes the first step out of the dank closet of books into the brightly lit ballroom of film. As soon as he figures out what to wear. As if on cue, Shane's mother calls down the stairs. Your dad's ready to take you to the airport. When he doesn't answer, she tries again. You don't want to be late, honey. Then, I made French toast. And, are you still deciding what to wear? Just a minute, Shane calls. And in a burst of frustration, mostly with himself, he kicks at the pile of clothes. In the ensuing explosion of fabric, the perfect outfit seems to float in midair. Whisker-washed boot-cut denims and a double-yoke western snap shirt. Perfect with his double-buckle biker boots. Shane dresses quickly, turns to the mirror, and rolls his sleeve so he can just see the right cross of the T in his tattoo. Now, Shane Wheeler says to his dressed self, let's go pitch a movie. Claire's Coffee Bean is crowded at 7:30. Every table sporting a sullen white screenwriter in glasses, every pair of glasses aimed at a Mac Pro laptop, every Mac Pro open to a digitized final draft script. Every table, that is, but the small one in back, where two crisp businessmen in gray suits face an empty chair meant for her. Claire strides over, her skirt drawing the eyes of the Coffee Bean screenwriters. She hates heels. Feels like a shoed horse. She arrives and smiles as they stand. Hello, James. Hello, Brian. They sit and apologize for taking so long to get back to her. But the rest is just as she imagined. Great resume, wonderful references, impressive interview. They've met with the full museum planning board, and after much deliberation, they offered it to someone who passed, she figures. They've decided to offer her the job. And with that, James nods at Brian, who slides a manila envelope forward on the little round table. Claire picks up the envelope, opens it a bit, just enough to see the words, confidentiality agreement. Before she can go further, James puts out a cautioning hand. There's one thing you should know before you look at our offer. he says. And for the first time, one of them breaks eye contact. Brian looking around the room to see who might be listening. Shit. Claire riffles through worst-case scenarios. The pay is in cocaine. She has to kill the interim curator first. It's a porn film museum. Instead, James says, Claire, how much do you know about Scientology? 10 minutes later, having begged the weekend to think over their generous offer, Claire is driving to work thinking, this doesn't change anything, does it? Okay, so her dream film museum is a front for a cult. Wait, that's not fair. She knows Scientologists, and they're no more cultish than the stiff Lutherans on her mother's side or her father's secular Jews. But isn't that how it will be perceived? That she's managing a museum full of the shit Tom Cruise couldn't unload at his garage sale? James insisted that the museum would have no connection to the church except to provide initial funding. That the collection would start with the donations of some church members, but the vast majority of the museum would be up to her to build. This is the church's way of giving back to an industry that nourished our members for years, Brian said. And they loved her ideas. Interactive CG exhibits for kids, a silent film vault, a rotating weekly film series, a dedicated film festival each year. She sighs. Of all the things they could be, why Scientologists? Claire mulls as she drives, zombie-like, all basic animal reflex. Her commute to the studio is a second-nature maze of cutoffs and lane changes, shoulders, commuter lanes, residential streets, alleys, bike lanes, and parking lots, devised to get her to the studio each day precisely 18 minutes after she leaves her condo. With a nod to the security guard, she drives through the studio gate and parks. She grabs her bag and walks toward the office, even her footfalls deliberating. Quit, stay, quit, stay. Michael Dean Productions is housed in an old writer's bungalow on the Universal lot, wedged between sound stages, offices, and film sets. Michael doesn't work for the studio anymore, but he made so much money for it in the 1980s and 1990s that they've agreed to keep him around, a scythe on the wall of a tractor plant. The lot office is part of a first-look production deal Michael signed a few years back when he needed cash, giving the studio the first crack at whatever he produced. Not much, as it turned out. Inside the office, Claire turns on the lights, slides behind her desk, and switches on her computer. She goes straight to the Thursday night box office numbers, early openers, and weekend holdovers, looking for some sign of hope that she might have missed, a last-second break in trend, but the numbers show what they've shown for years. It's all kid stuff. All pre-sold comic book sequel 3D CGI crap. All within a range of algorithmic box office projections based on past performance, trailer, poster, foreign market, test audience reaction. Movies are nothing more than concession delivery now. Ads for new toys. Video game launches. Adults will wait 3 weeks to get a decent film on demand, or they'll watch smart TV, and so what passes for theatrical releases are hopped-up fantasy video games for gonad-swollen boys and their bulimic dates. Film, her first love, is dead. She can pinpoint the day she fell. 1992, May 14th, 1 a.m., 2 days before her 10th birthday. When she heard what sounded like laughter in the living room, and came out of her bedroom to find her father crying and nursing a tall glass of something dark, watching an old movie on TV. Come here, pumpkin. Claire, sitting next to him as they quietly watched the last two-thirds of Breakfast at Tiffany's. Claire was amazed at the life she was seeing on that little screen, as if she'd imagined it without ever knowing. This was the power of film. It was like deja vu dreaming. 3 weeks later, her father left the family to marry Chesty Leslie, the 24-year-old daughter of his former law partner. But in Claire's mind, it would always be Holly Golightly who stole her daddy. We belong to nobody, and nobody belongs to us, She studied film at a small design school, then got her master's at UCLA,